Thank you very much for joining us for our most recent Tech Law 10. This is an important milestone. This is our bicentennial number 200. This is Eric Sinrod with Dwayne Morris, as always, joined by Jonathan Armstrong of Quarterly. And we have our special guest making a return. He was with us on number 100, the chairman of Dwayne Morris, John Sirocco. John, do you have any initial comments before we proceed?
Thank you. Thanks for having me back for number 200, and I look forward to number 300, hopefully.
We hope so, too. So the format today is we're going to each, Jonathan and I each have selected three topics that we've covered during podcast 100 to 200 over the last couple of years. So, Jonathan, why don't you start with your first topic of note?
Yeah, thanks very much, Eric, and thanks for joining us, John. My first topic is something that I think is dominating minds here in Europe, the new General Data Protection Regulation. So we've talked about it on a few of our podcasts in the last 100. It's obviously consequential changes to privacy law. I was at InfoSec last week, the big sort of trade show of the information security community, and it was the talk of the town. One of the vendors, for example, had a bus re-sort of logoed as the GDPR clinic bus that sat outside of the conference. And as I say, almost all of the vendors had some sort of GDPR offering or solution. But one of the things that I thought was worth just a quick 2 minutes is the ability for legislation like GDPR and its extraterritorial effect to almost provoke trade wars. Now, we had a French official some years ago say that privacy law and its conflicts with e-discovery were the new transatlantic trade war. And obviously GDPR sets the bar somewhat higher. Some might say that US corporations are unfairly disadvantaged in GDPR, because whilst the fines are the same for EU and US corporations, a US corporation that targets EU individuals but doesn't have a foothold in the EU has to have a data protection representative, somebody who will underwrite their fines, if you like. How that will be enforced, we don't know, but it seems as if the intention of leveling the playing field could have a disadvantageous effect on U.S. corporations. And I guess my worry in the current environment is whether we need anything else to sort of provoke trade restrictions, or whether it's a time when we should be reaching out to see if there are ways in which we can work together rather than call each other's systems at work and try and bring in these punishments. I wondered if either of you had any views on that.
Well, I can jump in quickly. This is Eric, and that is, and I do think we need to have some uniformity and harmony internationally when it comes to privacy issues. We've got different standards with respect to data flow going between countries. You know, generally speaking, I think Europe has been more strict in protecting privacy. You know, we hear when we're advising in the U.S., we do explain that, you know, good privacy is good business, and privacy is sort of like oxygen for consumers. You know, you don't really notice it until it's gone, and it does need to be protected. John, do you have any comments?
No, I agree. I agree with you, and it's a fast-evolving situation. I'm the amateur looking at from the outside. You guys have the more expert view on this, but obviously as the person responsible for these kinds of issues within our organization, it seems that these issues keep mounting up.
Good point. Okay, well, so for my first of my three...
Quick question, if I can, Eric.
Please.
Sorry to put you on the spot, John, but what do you think the visibility is of issues like GDPR with the sort of, you know, heads of major multinational law firms? Do you think that's somebody on everyone's radar, or do you think you're semi-unique in that?
I think this is in the process of migrating from the desks of those charged with responsibility for information services, IT directors and the like, getting more onto the desks of law firm chairmen as more of the cybersecurity type requirements are infiltrating their way into the profile of engagements we have for clients. So clients are saying to their law firms, we want to hire you to do this business transaction. We want to hire you to handle this dispute in court. But first, we want to know internally how you're handling security, how you would be handling our client files, and that thing, I think, is taking it from more of a cloistered area where it's on the desk of a law firm's IT director and putting it more front and center on the desks of people who run law firms, because they're seeing there's a linkage between having that under control on the one hand and continuing to add clients and do business on the other hand.
Very good point. Thank you. Good question, Jonathan. So it's my number one of three is the one story that kept coming back multiple times, probably more than any other story, and that's Ashley Madison. As we know, Ashley Madison is the world's largest adult-oriented website, in a way, I should say, in terms of the number one world website for married people to go and potentially link up with other people. And at its peak, Ashley Madison had over 38 million, quote-unquote, anonymous subscribers. And on the website homepage, it said, life is short, have an affair. Well, what was the problem? Well, as we learned, the site was hacked, and those 38 million anonymous users no longer were anonymous. And there were many repercussions. Some marriages broke up as people were outed. Some people actually lost jobs. Believe it or not, in some states, adultery is still illegal. And then it got even more intense when we came to learn that some foreign powers obtained the identities of people that used the site and were threatening them, essentially saying, if you do not cooperate with us and turn over state secrets, for example, from the United States, we're going to blackmail you. So there were many wrinkles to the story. It was obviously interesting in terms of content and procedure, but it really brought home the vulnerability we have in terms of information now living out in the wild on the Internet. So if either of you have comments on that story, love to hear them.
I have a quick thought. I was at a conference in Gibraltar this week, and I think, again, it's indicative of the point John just made about this sense of top of the organization. The conference in Gibraltar was attended by the governor, who not only gave a sort of kickoff speech, but he was there for the full day and seemed very engaged. I had a chat with him for 20 minutes or so, very engaged in the whole topic. And the Chief Minister of Gibraltar was there as well, who'd flown back from giving a speech in the UN to come and appear for the second half of the conference. So I think it's definitely at the very top of organizations. And Ashley Madison was still being talked about at this conference, exactly to your point, Eric, in that it allows people to be compromised. I think it's staggering. You know, one of our clients said, I think that north of 20 people in a large, you know, respectable corporation had signed on to an adultery site using their work email.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that compromises the organization as well as them as individuals, because you know the dark web is full of these lists of Ashley Madison users. This is used the same email and the same password, and that's relatively common, then by the adultery site being compromised, then so is the corporate network. So, you know, it's not just something of almost snigger and prurient interest. I think it's a real vulnerability for corporations. If John has a view.
I think it, yeah, I mean, obviously with the case specifically of Ashley Madison, the reason there's sort of an enhanced attention to that is because of the nature of the site. potentially embarrassing information, but embarrassing information can take many, many forms. It could take financial information. It could take other personal details that aren't of an explicitly sexual nature. So the whole idea of putting out personal data, putting out personal information on the internet, on sites that you are using because you believe them to be secure, and then learning that those sites or those operators have had a quote-unquote data breach is pretty harrowing. I mean, I think we've seen that story enough times now that people are sort of getting used to hearing that. Maybe they understand all the implications of it. Maybe they don't. But you're even hearing it with something as G-rated as major retailers having these kinds of data breaches. What does it really mean? You know, the television news certainly does a good job of giving a headline that there's been that kind of data breach. There isn't much analysis provided as to what that might mean for the affected consumers.
That's a very good point.
So, Jonathan, you're number two.
Okay. Yeah, my number two is a topic that I guess we could talk about for a day. But it's this whole issue around privacy activism, suspicion of government, et cetera, et cetera. So from the Snowden revelations to the Schrems litigation, and we've talked quite a bit about Max Schrems case, and as many of you know, I sat down and chatted with him in October about where he thought that, you know, the future of privacy was going and consumer activism against technology and its use, et cetera, et cetera. Remember, it all starts with allegations that Snowden made about the activities of the U.S. Security Services in particular and their viewing of people's material on the internet. And then this individual Austrian law student, Max Schrem, started this litigation which led to Safe Harbor, the scheme which was used by many U.S. corporations to legitimize the transfer of data from the EU to the US. It led to that collapsing. And I thought one of the interesting things that we could discuss in the next couple of minutes is where that goes next. Schrems and I had quite a good conversation, I thought, about how privacy regulation and fair trade regulation and antitrust regulation can't be seen in isolation. That in some respects they're three corners of the same triangle. And I think that we've had some examples of that more recently. You know, for example, in the European Commission's intervention into a recent merger deal, when the organisation concerned said that they wouldn't be merging data, and then they did. So what sort of market privacy issue then gets fined under the antitrust regime? And it's this almost like this complexity of digital regulation with different, as I say, corners of the same triangle, but also this rise of very intelligent and inventive activists who are using all sorts of different legal arguments and constraints as a crusade against some big businesses and their perceived bad practices. I wonder if either of you had a view in that. Has it always been thus, John? You've litigated these sort of consumer actions for longer than Eric and I put together, I guess. So have we always had these individuals with a cause that has fought through the conclusion?
Well, we've always had dissident and activist shareholders, but clearly the ability to magnify their message, just as we have seen political messages magnified, is something that's growing exponentially, and we used to describe those types of conflicts as David and Goliath type battles. Well, David these days has weaponry that's a lot more potent than a slingshot, right? And you really are moving from an era of what used to be 30, 40 years ago, asymmetrical warfare where might equaled right, to an environment in which individuals can take on certainly corporate structures, be a dissident shareholder or a dissatisfied consumer, and you can see a very, very real impact. Eric?
Thank you. Yes, and I'll pick up on a different strand. You were talking about mergers, Jonathan, and you know, we know that when companies now merge, we have to look at the private data they have and what assurances were given to consumers when they collected that data. So if a certain level of privacy protection was promised when a consumer gave information to a company A that then merges with company B, that merged company now still needs to protect data in the same way as originally promised. But you make an interesting point about the antitrust implications, and you know, we're now like living in a world where you can actually have market power when it comes to private data, which is maybe something we should devote to another podcast. It's a very interesting topic. So I'll now move on to my number two, and that has to do with Hillary Clinton's private email server. I remember saying long before the election in one of our podcasts that this issue was going to be the Achilles heel for Hillary Clinton, and I said so regrettably. Because, as you know, I've had cases up to the United States Supreme Court dealing with the transparency of government information under the Freedom of Information Act and other sunshine laws. And I explained that, you know, maybe the intent wasn't malevolent, but the fact was, by putting her transactions as head of the State Department on a private email server, the data no longer is being treated as a government record that could be accessible to the public under proper procedures. And it was a recurrent theme of even got to the point of lock her up. I mean, it got pretty shrill. But nevertheless, it was the issue of issues that really dogged her in the presidential campaign. And she's not president issue. So, any thoughts, guys?
Well, you know, I look at it not from a partisan standpoint. We all have our own personal views on the outcome of the election. I do tend to agree with you that while she did not wind up facing any criminal jeopardy because of what she had done, and I'm not expressing her opinion as to whether she should have or she shouldn't have. That would be an interesting legal issue for a different show or a different type of show. I do think I agree with you that formal prosecution or not, it certainly took its toll on her from a credibility standpoint and otherwise during the election. I couldn't resist during that whole episode to reflect on the fact that we at our law firm would not tolerate something that she believed was tolerable in her capacity as the U.S. Secretary of State, which is to conduct official business other than through the official electronic channels of the organization. And I can tell you that both I and our firm's general counsel, we are extremely vigilant when people, often by accident or inadvertence, send emails using what they may also own as a parallel Gmail address. Sometimes perhaps they've just hit the wrong button, and the next thing you know, you're talking about firm business, and the person who's emailing you back and forth isn't using the at Duane Morris account, but maybe using an at Gmail account, we make sure that that gets corrected immediately. And we have a very strict understanding for a lot of very good, real, and important reasons that we don't take firm business offline. And yet here you rather implausibly had the Secretary of State of the United States, who I would think would be dealing in information at least as important and at least as sensitive as a junior associate at Duane Morris, purposely routing all of that other than through the official government platform. You know, if someone told you that was happening, you might say, well, I can't believe anybody would do that. Yet here it was done, and it was defended. Pretty incredible.
I think that's a great observation. And I think, obviously, we can talk endlessly about whether it was a nation state that went and picked up the documents and abused them, and we talked about on podcast before. I certainly have evidence with my own eyes from a conference I spoke at that they spoke with the desk emails, but there's definitely, I'd just say that there's definitely something foreign, non-American, non-English at work. But the reality is that if you like, to follow on John's thought, that data had already been put in the middle of the street. It wasn't kept within the four walls of the organization. So we can criticize whoever we want to criticize for picking the data up, but it was already left vulnerable by Hillary's actions in November 13. And I guess I've got two particularly happy memories of that podcast, Eric. Firstly, because you called it correctly, but secondly, because I can still remember standing on the balcony as the sun went down in Cornwall, and that's what's getting me through today. I'll be there back again at the weekend. So it's always that the more I'm reminded of that sort of happy place, the better for me.
And I was sad to have been correct, by the way. So what's your number two, Jonathan?
As a number three.
Number three, excuse me.
Yeah, and it sort of vaguely follows on from the last one, in that I think that there's been, I mean, one revolution in my professional life has been how quickly you can become almost a monopoly. And that's particularly the case in some of these new tech offerings. So if you take Uber, for example, they go from almost from nothing to darling, to monopoly, to hatred in some quarters, in, I guess, 2 or 3 years, when it may have taken, you know, the old industrialists, I don't know, the Carnegies of this world, maybe 65 years to go through that whole scope from, you know, beloved monopolist hatred. I'm not suggesting Carnegie's hated, but certainly very much a monopolist. And I think Uber have achieved a number of things, really. But I guess one of the concerns, if you look at that triangle again, is, first of all, they're a monopolist. Secondly, or a quasi-monopolist in some areas. Secondly, are they behaving fairly with their riders and with their employees in areas like, for example, the allocations that they don't disclose, the fact that they're looking at battery strength, that they're charging female riders more if they're in vulnerable areas. They've had some bad press in the UK for surge pricing for people trying to leave a kerosene. It's fair to say that Uber have reversed those transactions, but they had some issues in between. And also whether they're properly disclosing the way in which they're using people's data and sweating that, so that, you know, that triumvirate, if you like, of fair trade, privacy, and antitrust. And also, I think it's shown us that a lot of these startup businesses don't invest in areas like compliance and legal structure and they grow perhaps too quickly for their own good. And then my slightly tongue-in-cheek comment that I stole off the internet is that somebody said, well, at least Uber have also achieved one other thing recently. They don't, as I understand it, have any C-level executives in post currently. One of their lead board directors recently resigned, and it was well publicized their CEO is undertaking a period of voluntary suspension. So if nothing else, Uber have succeeded in engineering the first self-driving company. So I wonder if any of you had any views on that.
Well, you certainly make an interesting point about how these companies grow so quickly in just, you know, accelerated telescope time as compared to historically. And, you know, here in the Bay Area where I work, we have so many examples of that. In fact, recently I took a trip up to Seattle, and so many of the large buildings in downtown Seattle are now fully occupied by Amazon. You know, Amazon is now all things in terms of purchasing goods on the Internet. Obviously, when you talk about Uber, you're referring to press reports, and we're not on the inside, and we're not here to comment necessarily on the propriety of Uber's actions, but it is an example of a company that's grown so fast, and it's, you know, valued at billions of dollars, but it also is, you know, operating at a loss. John, what is your thought in terms of, you know, the rapid growth of these new Internet companies?
Well, it's interesting. I look at it as sort of a model for law firms in the following sense. You know, it is a good cautionary note for law firms that to the extent there is that kind of disruptive innovation or disruptive change that can take hold in the legal industry, two things. It will take hold. And the changes that it will produce will be faster than perhaps law firms and their managers are prepared to adapt. And in a way, Uber is a very good example of it. There is a client-centric or customer-centric element to the use of Uber that is not dissimilar to the transition that law firms are undergoing. You know, in the old days or older days, a law firm and the associates it operated and partners it operated looked a little something like a commercial fleet of taxi cabs, right? The goal of the law firm was to have customers and all the cabs and all the cabs in motion, and after those cab rides were over, there was a dollar amount or an amount in pounds that was on the meter, and the customer really had to pay it. The customer was not in control. The operator was, and then you would just go get another customer. And Uber really reflects a much more customer-centered model or client-centered model that's a lot more like the shift of power these days away from law firms to the clients. So I've often said to our lawyers here, there may not be an Uber model per se that is going to challenge law firms, but do please realize that 20 years ago, prosperous owners of big taxi cab fleets probably thought they had an unbeatable business. And look what happened, and look at the speed with which it happened.
Interesting perspective. Thank you. All right, so we're now rounding the bend. This is my final number three. Probably not too surprising. You know, we're hearing 24/7 nonstop about, you know, Russia investigations on Capitol Hill, right? So what does that have to do with this podcast? Well, you know, partisan issues aside, at bottom, at least 17 of our intelligence agencies have concluded there were efforts made by Russia to meddle and interfere with our most recent presidential election. And we, you know, we've heard about, you know, fake news and what was put out vis-a-vis Russia onto social media that could have influenced people. We're now hearing more recent reports of actual efforts to penetrate our election systems. And it's something worth reflecting on, because one thing we think of as relatively sacrosanct as a hallmark of democracy is that if you don't like it in Washington, you can vote. And you can put in the representative of your choice as president or in the Senate or in Congress and in local elections too. And now we're learning, because there's so much that's done now electronically, as opposed to putting a hard copy, vote in a ballot box, there can be, potentially mass tampering. And maybe we're a little bit losing sight of that in these Russian investigations, as opposed to, who might have done wrong and who might be obstructing justice, as opposed to what's going on and how do we now actually protect democracy in this new cyber era. Gentlemen?
I think that's a very, wise observation and also very challenging. It seems to me that I think there's always been, since time immemorial, I think, foreign and subversive influence in elections. But it's almost the same side of some of the things that we've been talking about already, is that technology just makes it all so much easier. And instead of, taking the Pony Express around the U.S. and leafleting every saloon bar in town, you can do that, virtually in minutes rather than, by horse in weeks. So it's almost the speed of dissemination that's the change, isn't it, rather than the will to influence elections.
Yes, and I think one has to, in all things, be careful to define the terms. The evidence, such as it is, seems to be much more in the direction of a campaign of what I'll call disinformation than in anything that really invaded the sanctity of the polling place per se. I mean, that is a potential threat, but we have a lot of people, misinterpreting the phrase, the Russians hacked the election, to mean something more basic than any of the evidence here suggests was done, and I think some of the best commentary on this has been that governments are always playing their little games against each other and sowing little seeds here and there, and at least to my knowledge there's been no evidence that any elector here in the United States wanted to vote for one candidate, but somehow the Russians were able to hack into the voting booth or hack into the process and change that vote for a different candidate.
Well, I hope you're right. I know that's something that's of concern, and hopefully it won't happen in the future. But listen, first of all, we want to thank John Sirota, the chairman of Duane Morris, for joining us today for this weekly Tech Walk, and our number 200 and going strong. So thank you again, all of you listeners, for joining us for this bicentennial. Thank you, Jonathan Armstrong, for being such a great colleague in this ongoing endeavor. So we're going to sign off now. This has been more like Tech Walk 30, but I think it's been worth it. I'm Eric Finrod. It's Wayne Morris. You can reach us through usual social media, which won't be hacked by anybody. And please keep up with us and keep providing thoughts for future podcasts. Any closing thoughts, Jonathan and John?
Thanks for having me for number 100 and 200, and we'll see you soon.
Jonathan?
Yes, thanks both. And very insightful, John. Really enjoyed the discussion today. Maybe I'll just say I'm Jonathan Baron from CorbyCompliance.com. We're going to post the podcast as usual on LinkedIn as well. So if anyone's got any comments, they can reach out to Eric or I or post on LinkedIn, and we'll join you. I guess regular service will be resumed in a week or so. I suppose.
All right.
Thank you for listening.
All right. Cheers. And I'm EJ Finrod at WayneMorris.com. Signing off. Goodbye.